is Clayton, and later tonight at 10 p.m. or so, I'll be DJing here as DJ Rupture, which is another name I'm known by. And thanks. Microphone? You can't hear me. This should be closer to me. Does this help? How's this? Better? Okay, great. I'll try not to move from side to side too much. Yeah, so thanks to HKW. It's funny, I was talking to my mother about this trip. I said, yes, I'm going to Germany. And she's like, oh, why? I said, oh, to talk about musical archives. And she laughed because it seemed so boring to her. She's like, you mean libraries? Like, and I said, yes, you know, to a room full of people. But I decided to start with this photo because this, it's the very first promotional image that was taken of me at the start of the 2000s. And it's an example of life imitating art. So a year after this photo, I was on a tour, like my first big tour, you know, 30 dates all around the US. And we were driving on a highway outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico, and a drunk driver slammed into the back of our van. And we were shaken up, we almost went off the road. Nobody was seriously hurt, but the back windows of the van shattered, and my two bags of records went out onto the highway. You know, so once we got the van under control and pulled over, I stepped outside, and I just saw this 200-meter trail of tiny pieces of records, you know, of my record collection scattered along the road. And because it was my first big tour, and because I was only vinyl in those days, it was like losing years of my life of digging, of listening, of searching. And so that was the first moment when I began thinking seriously about musical archives. And of course, you know, DJs are good archivists and bad librarians. I say they're bad librarians because most DJs don't like to share what they got or where they got it from. They like to sort of suppress the information. You know, it's a long been a history of, you know, Jamaican sound systems soaking the labels off their records so competitors couldn't track it down. And in my case, after this accident happened, I was trying to buy back all the records I could, but the most difficult ones to get, the most valuable to me, were actually the cheapest. There were these little, you know, Jamaican 7-inches, reggae, dancehall reggae, which cost $3 a piece, but they had very short runs. And so I wrote my like reggae DJ friend saying, hey, this accident happened, can you help me out? Can you, you know, dub the Acid Rain rhythm, these vocalists? And basically they all said no, you know, my friends. And they're like, sorry, but this is our fire. You know, we've worked hard to amass these collections. So you're out of luck. So that's the bad librarian side of it. But DJs are good archivists insofar as the whole art form of DJing evolved in response to the ubiquity of recorded music, records. And DJing, it's kind of the most hands-on moment with the archive that many of us will have, which is to say, you know, it's literally taking these spirals of sound, sort of fixed processes, and then re-enlivening them. Then maybe you loop them, maybe you mix them, you fold them into your own narrative. And it's a narrative which is meant to be public, it's meant to be shared with bodies in space. It's turning the data of the archive into style, into sweat, you know, into a cultural moment and really generating that heat. And so that to me remains this sort of key moment where musical thinking can help us, you know, sort of strategize and imagine different ways of engaging with the archive. And another aspect of DJing, which is very important, is this idea that the archive is vast and there's a lot of junk in it. And that junk is important because it means if you look long and hard enough, you'll find those overlooked gems, which are particularly useful for the certain moment in a DJ set. But this notion that the archive needs a certain amount of excess, that it can't be based on quality, that you need the chaos and the multitude of life for it to have any true and lasting value. But if this example of me, of one drunk driver, you know, destroying my 200 best records, if that shows the problems of a small, relatively unprotected physical archive, the news this week of MySpace is a very good and stupid example of the problems with digital archives. And so at one point, you know, early 2000s, MySpace was the largest social network. And it sort of hit mainstream news this week that they recently deleted 12 years of user-uploaded audio from 2013 to 2015. So roughly 50 million songs were gone because they didn't want the storage space, because it was too annoying to manage. And people will make jokes, say, oh, MySpace was a ghost town, nobody went there. But I just did a quick calculation. I'm like, 50 million songs, that's, and if they're short songs, that's still around 237 years of music if you listen to them one after the other. And you know, maybe the first 236 years are terrible, but that's 1 year of amazing music that could have spoken to you. That's some executive, you know, some sort of cost-benefit analysis simply erased, which is very scary, you know, and it's obviously has the problems of centralization, the problems of sort of corporate control. What does it mean when a corporation takes over a kind of what we understand as an infrastructure or something public? And even within that, I should say that there was a warning. 10 years prior, in 2009, MySpace purchased iMeme. And so iMeme was a social network, around 16 million users. And I knew it as the best location to find out about the music that became known as footwork, you know, juke music from Chicago. So young black kids in South Side of Chicago were making this very energetic, very creative, rapidly evolving take on Chicago house, drum and bass, high speed. It was operating in tandem with a very lively dance scene, and kids were all archiving it on iMeme. But so MySpace bought it, and then without warning, the next day, they just simply deleted it. All those archives were vanished. And I think it's been gone over a fair amount in this conference of sort of what these types of problems are. You know, what does it mean when what we understand as convenience, oh, I can just stream it, suddenly turns into, but I've uploaded my files, my songs, my personal photos to this service, whether it's MySpace now or Facebook or Instagram in the future, uploaded to the service which decides to simply that it doesn't matter, you know, although they require our affective energies and our sort of love to create communities online, once it no longer becomes important to them, it's gone. And so MySpace, it still feels a little bit old. I think if we're talking about sort of the contemporary mainstream individual musical library, we're going to talk about streaming services like Spotify. We are not going to talk about SoulSeek. But with Spotify, I have another sort of personal story of sorts, which is that me, I believe like every other Spotify user, got emailed in December, and it was saying, listen again to the songs you listened to most in 2018. And I said, okay, I'll do their clickbait game. I'll go to the website. And Spotify told me that I'd been listening, my number one song of 2018 was Shittin' Lately by an LA rapper called 03 Greedo. And I said, oh yeah, that's an amazing song. I haven't listened to it in a few weeks. Like, let's revisit Shittin' by Greedo. And so since I'm already in Spotify, I just type it in and I can't find it. I'm like, this is weird. I do a wider search, and it turns out that within the few weeks since I'd last listened to that track, it had been the whole album it was on had been taken down by Spotify. And so I wrote Spotify to ask what had happened, and they told me that they could not tell me why it was taken down. You know, they said, likely due to copyright violations, but that's the end of the story. So I had to go to YouTube, and it is a great song, so I'll play. This is a YouTube rip, and the image provided is by the user that put up the track. Shittin' Lately by Greedo.
Counting up, bitch look bad with no makeup. She give me big face like a Jacob. Spend a little time, but never no dime. Committed crimes just to get a payment. Put my kids on her belly, she still ain't pregnant. Too many rounds on my waistline. Might hit a house in the daytime. Might try a four with that walk hard. I'm trying to see what it tastes like. I want that chain with this green Buddha. Just to give me a thing with that big old booty. Put that gold in my mouth, I want every color. One burgundy gold and one white and one yellow. Water might leak out the eyes on my bezel. And catch a hoe slipping just like rainy weather. Make it rain, make it rain.
You can go search for it somewhere in the wilds online. But a great track. But I remain curious. I was like, why is this gone? What's going on? What does it mean for me if, you know, the very same company that told me this is the content of theirs that I most accessed had removed it? And so I wrote Greedo's manager and received no reply. And I made a few other inquiries, nothing. But what most likely happens is this. Last July, Greedo was sent to jail for 20 years on a drug violation, a felony case. And this song and the album, Purple, was from 2016. So it'd been online, it'd been on Spotify for the past 2 years. So I was like, why now? And in all likelihood, it's probably because while in jail, he was unable to do the legal busy work necessary to clear maybe an unauthorized sample claim, to sign a deal with Spotify, sharing profit, et cetera, et cetera. So you get this case where, you know, the American criminal justice system, with all of its disastrous effects and its dehumanizing qualities and its bigotry, it removes this man from society, and then as a secondary step, it slowly starts withdrawing his cultural contributions. Since then, other Greedo albums are slowly leaving Spotify. And again, because Spotify is such, you know, an opaque machine, this is all purely conjecture based on why most things get removed from Spotify and looking at who was able to fight back and how. So we're seeing an example of someone leaving the archive, in this case Spotify. And I, you know, as the person introducing me said, I do see it as streaming services as a site of ritual sacrifice for musicians. You go there, you give them your work and your love and this thing you've created in exchange for what is literally microsense and some sort of vague promise of visibility or audibility, which ends up being very, very fragile. But then the second part of my Spotify story involves this man, American composer, also from LA, named Carl Stone. And so Spotify said the second song you listened to most in 2018 was Shing Key by Carl Stone from 1986. And I said, actually, you know, Spotify's metrics are off because Shing Key is a long track. It's, you know, it's 5 times longer than the Greedo song. So while I listened to it fewer times, I spent more of my year inhabiting this song by Carl Stone than any other, clearly. And Carl Stone's important to the discussion because his career as a musician-composer began in the late 70s. He exists in this kind of parallel track with hip-hop culture. He began using, you know, turntables and tape machines and tape loops to sample from the vast wealth of recorded music and kind of zooming in on these microseconds of sound, you know, just the same as all sorts of DJs in New York were doing. People were realizing, hey, you don't need to listen to the whole song. You can take 3.2 seconds, cut it up in interesting ways, and that can give you a whole new window, creating a whole new process. And Shing Key, the piece I was going into over and over again, it's based on a Schubert Lieder sung in English by a Japanese pop star called Akiko Kano. Here's a little clip.
Before the doorway, there stands a linden tree. Out beneath its shadow, sweet dreams have come to me.
It's nothing I would ever listen to voluntarily. Like, I don't like that song, but what Carl Stone did to it is completely incredible. He takes these two very small samples and turns them into this wonderful, slowly evolving 15-minute opus about love and intimacy and all the magic that can happen in this little tiny buffer of sound. You know, as a composer, he's actually thinking a bit more like a database. He's not thinking about, oh, rhythm and swing and funk. He's thinking, what happens if I adjust the code in my max patch so that it's 700 milliseconds versus 650 milliseconds? What would that do? But to give you an example of this song that I sank into so deeply, this is a few seconds of Carl Stone's reinterpretation, versioning of the Akike Kano Schubert. So taking what I would consider to be sort of junk, the previous song, he transforms it utterly. And Carl Stone is doing something that happens in a lot of DJ culture and a lot of sample-based music, which is saying, you know, we can play with time itself. We can play with how time is received. We can play with how time is perceived. We can take a piece, we can dive into the archive, reconfigure it, and make something new, provocative, and different by simply altering that temporality. And that type of work does not play well with these sort of corporate archives. Me, as a DJ, over the years, I've seen how my mixes are becoming less and less available online. You know, they were first downloaded as MP3s, and then sites like SoundCloud came along. In the beginning, SoundCloud made an effort to court DJs. They understood were these weird tastemakers, you know, dealing with filters and excessive music. But soon after that, they began putting in the sort of sample sniffing algorithms that would prevent you from uploading things, which is also happening on YouTube and on all these other sites. So whereas once I feel like my discography was wild and wildly available, now every year it's becoming less so. And so that's a lot personally to think about, how I'm slowly being written out of this very specific digital narrative. And so much of the music I love, it's happening to as well. You know, it's happening to Greedo. And I'm thinking, and it might happen to Carl Stone in the future, which is to say, the algorithms get smarter and scan more. They might realize that he's gotten a Motown sample in one song, you know, that he's got this Akiko Kano in another. And so perhaps his body of work, too, will become less and less available simply because of these issues of copyright intersecting with corporate archives. But one of the things that connects, another one of the things that connects Carl Stone and Mr. Greedo is their sort of shared concern, their shared meta-theme of consumption. With Carl Stone, you know, for decades now, he's been naming all of his songs after restaurants, places where he's eaten, digested, processed. And of course, Greedo, you know, it's both the bounty hunter, who was shot by Han Solo, famously, but then also this idea of greed. And Greedo, as a rapper, was putting out lots and lots of mixtape. His ideas of consumption and production as a reaction to the, you know, our dwindling attention spans, he was like, I must make more and more and more. And even now he's in jail, he released a new single last week that was recorded previously. But I mentioned there are these ideas, the sort of meta theme of eating and digestion, because it's a very specific response to the sort of ubiquity of data and information overload. Both of these artists are saying there are other ways, like that's kind of what we are. We're these sort of stomachs moving around and consuming. And so let's think about process. It's less about creation. It's less about destruction even. And it's more about the simple sheer fact of eating. And that brings me to one of the main, perhaps maybe like one of the main features of the contemporary music archive, the contemporary digital archive. And I like to say, like an archive, a digital archive, it is the database that has the stuff. It has the ones and the zeros. It has whatever digitized content you've put into it. And then on the other side, there's the interface. It's how we access all those abstract numbers, how we pull them up. And this, of course, is radically different from walking into a library, browsing the shelf. And the sort of scary and overwhelming thing is that as more and more information fills all these various databases, public or private, you know, corporate or open sourced, more and more information enters the database, but the interface side of it remains simple and tends to get more and more simplified. And so maybe the prime example of a violently simplified user interface is, of course, the famous Google splash page. You know, so there's this idea of, well, what do? You formulate, how do we learn about the world? We go to Google and type in the thing that we want to know, which is a tiny little way of thinking about research, of thinking about generating knowledge, and it's hyper-reductive. And so with something like with many of the streaming services, for example, you can only search by artist name, album name, maybe genre or mood, things like this. And that is a kind of disaster for me. And primarily, it's a disaster for many reasons, but the thing I think of most often with any sort of archive, like archives are great, but what's key and vital is access to that archive. And I don't mean the ability to simply, you know, walk in and find what you want, you know, to do your directed micro search, but access as the idea that we can go into this archive, take materials from it, and transform them into some sort of public narrative. That ability to enliven, extract, and cut one's own course through the archive, that's key. And with this aggressive oversimplification of the interfaces, it becomes harder and harder to think about that. You know, and just as a thought process earlier today, I was like, oh, well, what would it mean, you know, what, like other ideas for interfaces? Oh, it's like Spotify, but you know, the anti-nostalgia Spotify. Every time you play a song you've played before, it's 5% slower and slower and slower until the end it's just a sludge, so you're forced to get new things. Or, you know, imagine this. This would be my personal, I think, favorite. It's like, you know, all the songs are there, but the interface is nonverbal. You need to sing or drum or tap or whistle, and whatever thing the algorithm understands you is doing, it will spit back. So it turns into this strange, and it could go on and on. You know, there's many, many ways of thinking about this. Geographic listening, like, oh, I love rap from LA. Let's look at the people in this area, the people who went to this high school, cross-referencing databases, weather and music. But the whole point about this is, I think some people think, oh, whatever the archive is, we must put in diverse and somehow representative content. And I'm like, you could do that, but maybe it's more interesting to focus on the other thing, which is to have diverse, chaotic, multi-layered, robust interfaces and relational linkages that allow people to access that content. And that will only become more important as the databases continue filling up. If we only have a tiny window, we're going to see very little. And there's a very real sense in which the archives and the algorithms train us. You know, you see it most explicitly in a video game where you need to learn the algorithm in order to beat or win, but you see it more gently with things like YouTube where the like button, these types of things, where we're sort of quantifying ourselves. And this idea of focusing on thinking about interface, thinking about ways to navigate through the archive, it brings together the database coders and the artists and the historians and the music fans. And so much about what is not wrong, because we're all implicated. So much of what is contemporary about music fandom is this idea that convenience trumps so much else. Like, I hate Spotify. You know, I'm going to stop calling them Spotify. I hate the wretched streaming service. And yet I pay them $10 every month. And that's an issue. Like, what does it mean to have an inconvenient archive or to have that extra 2 minutes of access to find things in ways which might be more complex, more sustainable? These are also strange words, but I think now I'd like to talk about two figures. I think I'll close my talk by discussing two figures who've meant a lot to me over the years. The first is Indiana Jones, and the second is Julius Eastman. We'll start with Indiana Jones. This is a clip from the third movie in the series, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade. It opens with River Phoenix playing the young Indiana.
You got heart, kid, but that belongs to me.
Belongs to Coronado.
Coronado's dead, and so are all of his grandchildren.
This should be in a museum.
I give it back.
This should be in a museum. It means so much to the franchise that the scene is repeated with the older Indiana Jones, played by Harrison Ford, later in the film.
Small world, Dr. Jones. Too small for two of us.
This is the second time I've had to reclaim my property from you.
It belongs in a museum.
So do you.
So do you. Ah, that's great. And so this, of course, you know, it's interesting now because there's this discussion happening in museums all across Europe about sort of giving back objects, relics to the countries, the context they were taken from, which is a whole other discussion. But here we see this example. You know, ever since he was a young lad, Indiana Jones has been passionate about finding valuable, unique cultural artifacts and taking them to places where they can be preserved, cared for, climate controlled, not touched, and presented for the public good, of course, or for the good of the public who can enter the museum, who lives in the same area as the museum. It's a lot. But Eastman's work is a kind of counterpoint to that, and my reading of a lot of his work is that, what if it shouldn't be in a museum? You know, what if he shouldn't be in a museum? What if he shouldn't be museumified? What if he should be forgotten? You know, or what if the archive should be allowed to self-destruct? And so, for those of you unfamiliar with him, Julius Eastman is a American vocalist, composer, black man, a gay man, who died in 1990 at the age of 49. And he has worked with, you know, Meredith Monk. He sang on her Dolman music. He performed John Cage pieces, knew all those people, Morton Feldman and so on. But he had this very contentious relationship to a lot of that. And so starting around 7 years ago, I began a project called the Julius Eastman Memorial Dinner, where I said to myself, okay, there are three things. I heard the music of Julius Eastman, and I'm like, this music is amazing. It's romantic, it's muscular, it's dense, it's delicate, it does so much. And then second, I was like, and I have no one I can talk with about Julius Eastman. Every time I would bring him up, I would get these blank stares by people who had never heard of him, which is understandable because it was very hard to encounter his music. And yet, from that period, he was active in the 70s and 80s in New York City. So much has been written about it. So much has been memorialized. I'm like, it is a very striking and conspicuous absence from the historical record. But thirdly, and for me, the sort of key point that made me want to think of a way to engage with this artistically was that Julius Eastman was also a problem. You know, by all accounts, He was kind of a jerk. He was hard to work with. He never backed away from friction. And he, of course, dealt with all sorts of layers of institutional racism and classism and all, you know, and anti-gay sentiment. But, you know, he would also show up drunk to rehearsals at 10 in the morning. And, like, he also was very interested in shooting himself in the foot as a way of working through the world. Which is to say, on the one hand, he was denied social visibility, but on the other, he fought against that visibility and recognized that that might not necessarily be the prize or the thing to aim for. And so I'm not going to talk about my project, I'm going to talk about him, but I am going to play a clip of it so you can hear a bit what he sounds like as processed and interrupted by me. And this clip is taken from the world's premier music archive site, Instagram. Oh, whoops, I skipped it. Since, you know, this project debuted, every year it's been fascinating for me to watch, because every year there has been more interest around Eastman's work, more context, more events, more festivals, newspaper articles. You get a lot of reissues, new recordings of his music. Basically, people have come together to sort of collectively put Eastman into the museum, more or less. And the typical response is you get a bunch of really good musicians, virtuosos, ideally, and you get them to perform and re-perform faithful renditions of his work, which is great. You know, so part of me is very happy about that, but it also feels like there's a lost chance with the sort of current Eastman craze or fandom or interest. And that chance comes from what I mentioned, that he was... I think he was interested in the problematic. He was interested in embodying the problem. And for me, this, and you can see it, for example, maybe the most obvious ways of seeing this is in some of the names of his compositions. You know, what, like Nigger Faggot, Gay Gorilla, If You're So Smart, Why Aren't You Rich, Evil Nigger, titles like that. And this is happening in the very specific, like, New York downtown new music scene, sort of white gallery spaces. And his cohort and companions, their naming convention was very much the sort of vanilla, self-referential, you know, music for 18 musicians, well-tuned piano. And then in contrast, you had Eastman, who was saying, there's all this grit and chaos and layers of power lines and tension outside the music. Why not bring it inside the music? And why not affix it to the name on the score? But he did it knowing full well that those titles would operate as kind of conceptual artworks, which would limit these scores' access to where they could and couldn't be performed, to where they couldn't be archived. And they would also sort of call attention to the bodies, you know, and sexualities of the players themselves. And all these issues were just kind of not, it wasn't to do the thing at the time, and it hurt him in many ways. You know, it's one of the reasons why he was sort of underperformed and underrecorded. But you can also see Julius Eastman's, you know, contentiousness with his own historiography in when you look at the scores, which you can't do right now because they have been taken down because of lawyer pressure. But back then, you could. You could download, sort of friends had uploaded PDFs, and this is an excerpt of one of them. And I don't know if you can see it, but on the right side, there are these very specific, down to the second, timing marks. But then on the left side, you get this sort of like dot, dot, dot Morse code chicken scratch. So these scores are, they're not kind of comprehensive scores. They're more of a gesture or a trace or a memory aid for musicians who'd gone in and received the sort of oral transmission of Eastman teaching the piece to them, guiding them through it in rehearsal, and then you would have this left over. But these scores themselves do not push towards reproducibility in that way. But so when I take a step back, I think so much of this man's work, implicit and explicit, has been built around the question of what is the historical record, and do I want to enter into it, and if so, why? He gave a famous pre-concert talk, and he's talking about specifically about the titles of some of these works. And Eastman goes in a very interesting kind of proto-Afro-pessimist take on things. He says, the nigger is that which is fundamental. And then he launches into this sort of very beautiful and very materialist consideration of labor and sexual exploitation went to create this figure which the American engine was founded on, and it can't be moved and has this base quality for all these reasons, you know. And then they play this piece of instrumental music for four pianos. But all these different aspects of Eastman's friction and his restlessness, to me, there are, it's actually encourages me to think about archives in a very interesting way. He was saying, you know, whether on the musical score, the musical record, he's like, what if we bring in all the subjective messiness of sex? What if we bring in the way economic violence is linked to race? What if we bring in, you know, jokes? What if we bring in the forgotten, the forbidden, profane language, all of these things which are somehow meant to be cleansed by the archive, that are not meant to pass through the walls of the archive, what if that's at the core of the work? You know, what if there's a suspicion of reproducibility or repeatability? What if the music is tied to the musician in such a way that they can't be separated? You know, he might say to us today, why are you talking about musical archives? Is it because we're talking about musical archives and thinking about care and maintenance because it's so difficult to provide care and maintenance to musicians themselves? So Eastman gives me a lot of his force and momentum remains quite present in terms of these issues and in terms of the ways in which I feel like he recognized back in the 70s and 80s that the score, the trace, the solid archive, the official narrative, it both filters out a lot of what makes life so particular and amazing, but it also is the touchstone for that we use to sort of create and narrate and perform whoever it is we are or whatever it is that our relationships might be, and therefore does need to be taken quite seriously in a sense of play. How do you open up an archive to that sort of both friction and seriousness, but guided by this sense of almost like a trickster sense of flipping and inversions that were really key to him as a musical thinker. So I am going to bring this talk to a close and leave you with a parting slide. The top, of course, Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark, that's a still, and the bottom is a photograph of the Amazon warehouse. And so now I believe we can open up to questions. Thank you. I've answered everyone's questions. Ah.
This is a bit of a question for you personally, just about your career in DJing. I'm curious to know, after you had that experience with your records, and when DJing opened up to digital more, did you venture into that, and how did your way of storing your own music develop?
Yeah, that's a great question. I forgot to say, after that car crash, you know, I mean, for like, it was like trauma for 3 months, you know, terrified of cars, trying to buy records, like, what's going on? Who am I? My musical identity is left in a highway in Santa Fe. This is stupid. But then I'm like, but no, like, it is about process, right? It's about this sort of extreme portability and style, whatever. And the musical knowledge that is most meaningful to me as a DJ, and any DJ, I think, is the sort of, you know, what you get from simply listening for so many years. And so much of about the art form is a improvisation with what's available. That said, there's still records to, I'm like, if only I had this. So, you know, I guess I should, dancehall reggae fans between 1993 and 2003, come talk to me afterwards. Like, maybe we can work something out. But when, you know, stuff like Serato, Serato's amazing because it's what I'll be using tonight. It uses the vinyl record, turntables, and a mixer as interface for playing digital files. And so, you know, people was like, hey, Jace, you should check this out. You know, and it was a very, I have no nostalgia for media formats, you know, and so, like, touring with 200 records is terrible. It's backbreaking work. Whereas this is my Serato set for tonight. And these digital analog hybrids are so wonderful precisely because they preserve the interface, which is hugely important for me. I'm like, oh, the records need to be big, and the toner needs to be big, and the mix, because I'm doing these sort of, very, you know, slow-moving blends, and, you know, a lot of my DJ style evolved from, oh, I can put three layers at once if I'm mixing three records very carefully and making these tiny adjustments, that you kind of can't really reproduce that sort of constant, tense nuance with digital formats so easily. So you need that hybrid interface. So that's been huge. And then the storing, actually, I love Soulseek, which I said I wouldn't talk about, because it hasn't been taken down. It looks the same as it did back in 2006 or whenever. And people store their files on it by their folders. So when you go to Soulseek and you're looking, you know, DJ Rupture, you can actually see how users are thinking about their music. And it's amazing. Like, there are people who will have, like, folders dedicated, like, tracks I downloaded from DJ Rupture's radio show, which I had 6 or 7 years ago, and I'm like, that's amazing. Like, I don't have that kind of archive. But my own digital archive is a mess, which I've never recovered from, so.
Hi. Just want to come back to your regrets, or like you mentioning, this loss in commercial archives, where MySpace is shutting down stuff. And I'm surprised that people come to these commercial sites with the assumption, or maybe like the notion, that they're sort of responsible for keeping all that stuff online. Mm-hmm. Whereas I have a feeling that with the traditional way these works get preserved over hundreds of years is by repetition and by copying and by basically interest of somebody in it for a prolonged time. Mm-hmm. So I was kind of wondering, like, with this other model that you just mentioned again, with this shared file sharing, where people are actually storing these files on their computers, and stuff that has interest gets sort of copied over, and you find even stuff that you didn't find worthy of archiving, like mm-hmm. your shows or something, and you find that somebody else stored it, and now you've got this. But it's because this is a distributed effort and not mm-hmm. like a centralized commercial thing. Does this notion of repetition, sort of by every participant, bring a new notion to this whole idea of preservation? Or
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And it's funny, I mentioned iMeme in part because I'm like, the culture on there that I found so interesting was teens who weren't thinking about, oh, like, copyright, is this mine? People, like, so much of the content is created in an unreflective state, you know, by people who simply aren't thinking about it, by young people who don't have that kind of, like, digital rights literacy as a second. But the fact that, you know, at the end of the day, it feels like all culture is oral culture. You know, it's like either you're speaking it and engaging it and activating it, or it will be forgotten or confined, you know, to the lower left corner of the gigantic warehouse somewhere and not accessed. So it's a real case for use, but then also for the ability to use, you know. And so, for example, so many of these streaming services, you don't have the MP3s. You can't do the weird remix and then put it in your hard drive. You need to rip it and then take all these extra steps just to get a hold of it. So I'm very interested in database structures that do, and archive structures that encourage use and reuse and that type of activity.
Where do you find junk online? Or is that proprietary?
Wow. Junk online. Yeah, that's actually a really interesting question, right? Because, yeah, this whole conception of, like, the library must be broad, it must contain multitudes if it's going to be of wide use to many people. And that's precisely the problem. Weirdly enough, that's actually the problem with, like, online search, because you're looking for what you want to find, so either you find it or you're frustrated in your search to find it. But there's this idea that junk, ads, spam, you know, the Akiko Kano track, are, like, I just ignore them in the search. So with movements online, there's no joy in the process of search, which is something that I do. Maybe that's my one point of nostalgia for, like, record stores, as elitist and awful and snobby as they are. I'm like, oh, but I would, in looking for certain types of music, I would enter into conversations. There would always be this social layer. The search itself had a pleasure and a fun to it, whereas even using my beloved SoulSeek or something, I'm like, it feels like engaging with a gray database, and that's what it is.
I just wanted to make a comment that amplifies a point that you made when you observed about Julius Eastman, is the care and maintenance that we've provided to these to musicians' archives a kind of compensation for the fact that we weren't able to provide care for the musicians themselves? And I wanted to just point out that question can apply to so many of the archives we've been talking about today, whether we're talking about colonial archives or we're talking about, in the United States, archival preservation of Native American cultural artifacts. And as we think about this question about, you know, how to relate to archival materials with a kind of mixed seriousness and friction, the question of the friction is always to be asking ourselves questions related to that question of dehumanization. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to thank you for that point, which can really be a kind of lodestar in thinking about how to approach the archive.
Yeah, thank you. And as a brief response to that, I kind of touched upon it with the Eastman, but even the previous question about sort of more peer-to-peer spots, like this idea of the centralized archive is wonderful, but then it's back to this, like, an one company, one individual, and there's something like what was like a shared commitment to these different types of maintenance? What would that look like if it's not simply, we need to talk to the big untalkable, you know? So, yeah. Okay, so I think that's good. I'll see you later tonight, and we can dance our way through the archive.